In a fast-changing world, innovation may not be a luxury, but rather a necessity. That's what we're talking about today, right here on the Remarkable Leadership Podcast. Let's go.
Welcome to the Remarkable Leadership Podcast. We are here each week to help you lead more confidently and make a bigger difference, both professionally and personally. This episode is sponsored by From Manager to Remarkable Leader, Kevin's flagship workshop based on his proven leadership model. Learn more at remarkablepodcast.com/manager. And now here's your host, Kevin.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Remarkable Leadership Podcast. So glad that you're here. You're going to be glad that you're here after you have the chance to learn from my guest today. I'm going to just dive right in and we're going to get started. My guest today is Samir Hazija. He is a professor of technology and operations management at INSEAD. His teaching focuses on the process lens to understand new levers of innovation. We're going to focus on innovation today. He emphasizes the role of process-based innovation in creating new business models and or competitive positioning for businesses. He conducts workshops for executives on understanding the latest developments in technology and their role in radically disrupting and or transforming businesses. He is one of the authors of the brand new book, the excellent new book, The Phoenix Encounter Method. We're going to talk about that some today as well. Samir, welcome.
Thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. We are in drastically different time zones. You are 11 hours ahead of, ahead of me. No, you are 13 hours ahead of me as we have this conversation. And so I'm so glad that we found the time to chat here. And we're chatting for all of you. We're chatting here at the near the end of 2020. You will all will be hearing this in 2021. So Samir, before we get into the details of the day, tell us a little bit about your background and your journey. I mean, you didn't wake up when you were five and say, I want to be a professor of technology and operations management. Like, I'm guessing that wasn't the original plan.
Not at all. Absolutely, Kevin. So, you know, it's a lot of serendipity of what kind of takes you forward. And, you know, for me, it was a little bit of luck. It was a little bit of mentoring that I got early on from you know, professors in college. I was an undergrad student for engineering in India, and one of the, you know, I read this book called The Goal. It's you know, this really old masterpiece,
and I really got influenced. Wait a minute! It's not that old. By the way, everybody, we'll put The Goal in the show notes. Fantastic book, and I remember reading it, so it can't be that old. Go ahead. So you read The Goal. So
I read The Goal as an engineering student, and there was this character in the book called Jonah, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do what Jonah did for a living, and I had no idea what that was, but it just seemed so incredible to me. And so I started finding out, and next thing you know, I ended up in a PhD program in upstate New York at the University of Rochester, and studying technology and operations management. And, you know, after that, it's just INSEAD picking me up, bringing me outside of the US to Singapore and to France. And it's been 12 years now, so the journey hasn't stopped, but it's just these series of things that happen in life that kind of bring you here. But I have to say, it is luck. It wasn't planned, but nonetheless, it feels as if it's the right thing. And I have to say, it's been a fun ride.
That's awesome. I love hearing sort of people's stories about what happens and what leads them. And it is a great book. The Goal is a great book. It's been a long time since I read it. And sorry that I interrupted the story, but man, it just made me feel old. Anyway, so this book, The Phoenix Encounter Method, I want to dive into some of the interesting things. There's no way we can do everything that you talk about in the book, but let's start with the big idea of the book. What's the big idea of the book?
Kevin, the big idea is we were struggling with with this notion that, you know, well, why do existing firms that are so good at what they do, at least at some point in their lives, with smart people running the show, with, you know, processes and technology available to them, including resources, why do they get disrupted, and why do they get disrupted so frequently? And there's so many ideas and theories that tell us what disruption is and how it happens, but none of them can tell us what to do if it happens. And so we started thinking a lot about this and realized that the biggest problem is, at the end of the day, we are trapped by our own experience. It is the very thing that in the past that made us good is what is stopping us from defending ourselves and protecting our position going forward. Because it creates blinkered thinking. It puts these kind of tunnel vision around us. And the thing about disruption is that it comes from all sorts of directions and places, and perhaps from places where we least expect it, which is why our experience in the past is not good enough to protect us from disruption. We have to rethink everything completely. And so we brought up this idea that if we have to imagine a future where we thrive and successfully maintain our position, if not take it to the next level, then we have to and we must break the blinkers. And in order to do that, we first must imagine our destruction. Think about all the things that could completely destroy us, take us down. And only then can we start imagining what our future will look like and what do we need to do to avoid such a destruction. And so the concept of the Phoenix Encounter method is to preempt the actual destruction, to imagine it, and then in the real world start putting in processes and strategies that can avoid it and perhaps even take the organization to its next level, let alone getting disrupted.
So in your work with all sorts of clients and businesses and organizations, I mean, we could all make the list, but I'm curious, what are there types of disruptions that you find seem to be harder for organizations to either acknowledge or overcome? Like, are there worse some disruptions that are worse than others? That, because if you want us to be thinking about this on the front end, so I thought that question was helpful to say, you know, maybe not all disruptions are created equal, right? So what are the kinds of things that you find are worst?
The worst ones are the ones that come outside of the core industry, where the disruptor is not an entrenched player or even a startup in the same vertical, where the disruption happened from a completely different industry and then kind of comes into this industry and takes them out. I mean, think about the iPhone, how the iPhone disrupted, let's say, the GPS industry. They didn't see it coming. What does a phone have to do with the GPS industry? And those are things which are the hardest to one predict and the toughest to defend yourself against, because not only are they hard to see, but even if someone sort of hints at it, you're very quick to be dismissive about it. You're like, what does Apple have to, yes, Apple is a great company, but what does it have to do with the GPS industry? We have the mapping technology, we have this. We cannot be taken out by them. I need to worry more about my competitors who are creating slightly better technology than I do, which then invariably leads to incremental innovation, because all I'm doing is trying to outdo the technology of my closest competitors. So that's the worst kind. And in that kind, Kevin, industries get taken out, not just companies, right? So they are worse because you don't see it coming, and they are worse because the impact is extremely, extremely big.
And sometimes pretty fast, right? Sometimes pretty fast. It's interesting that you said that, because the iPhone gets used for all sorts of examples, right? And people were listening along or watching along, and they probably weren't thinking GPS. Some people that are watching us don't even remember that there was a separate box that people bought that was a GPS, right? Some people are like, what is a GPS? It's just maps in my phone, right?
I'm not kidding you. You know, I'm going to bring the age thing up again, but this time along with you, Kevin. I don't teach MBA students very often nowadays, but, you know, every now and then I do get into the class. I got into teaching MBA students after 5 years this year, primarily because some of my colleagues who were supposed to come in from France to our Singapore campus to teach couldn't come in. And so I had to step in. Now, I was talking about the GPS. I was about to talk about the GPS industry. And I was just, I didn't think about it. But the minute I brought it up in class, I suddenly realized that my audience in front of me may not have any idea of what I'm talking about. And so I put this image of TomTom, like this thing that goes in. And you know, most of them, luckily for us, it's still not that old. They kind of knew it. But there were a few who hadn't really seen it, right? And you know, you're absolutely right. So, you know, these things happen so fast that they disappear and they're gone in oblivion.
2007, I believe, is the first iPhone. So if you're talking to some MBA students, they're like nine, you know, when the iPhone came out, right? I don't even, yeah. I we got to change the subject. Okay, so I really love the metaphor of the phoenix, and you sort of got us there, right? That we've got to sort of seek, and then we've got to be willing to burn so that we can rise from the ashes, if you will. So tell us a little bit. I mean, this is a very readable book, but it's not a short book. I'll just hold it up for people that are watching. And you outline a whole very specific and distinct process. So tell us about the process at a high level now that you've got us thinking about, okay, we've got to recognize disruption and get in front of it. What are the high level pieces of the process that you all teach?
See, ultimately, Kevin, at the very high level, because this is a process of a simulation in a sense, right? It's like a role play kind of thing. The ultimate aim is to be able to do two things, if nothing else, at least two things. The first thing is to create an attitude, a mindset shift, okay, which is really, really important. And the second is to populate the playbook of any leader with options that they previously had not thought about. And the third, a good side outcome, but a very good one, is that it helps build the burning platform for the rest of the organization, which is, as you know, anything from change management, it's not easy to convince people that we need to change, right? So this really facilitates building the burning platform, which then lends itself nicely to change management. These are the three main outcomes. Now, with these three outcomes in mind, the process, so the reason I brought these outcomes is because then the process will sort of start making sense, because if that's my goal, then I can lay out the path much better. So the process is very simple. It starts with groundwork preparation. And if it is the mindset, which is my primary goal, then I need to start preparing the ground by making people see the world, which may be very different than their own world. We call it scanning, which means you start by looking at everything around you. It doesn't matter what your industry is. You should know what's happening in other industries. It doesn't matter what geography you operate in. You should know what's happening in other geographies. You may not have a business in Myanmar. You may never go into Myanmar, but it's very useful for you to know if there's something interesting going on there, because that's a learning opportunity you don't want to miss, right? Anyway, so the groundwork part is the scanning part, is trying to understand what, making sense of the world in its current state, and then understanding trends. The second stage is what we call as the battlefield. And the battlefield, we first enact out an attack. And this attack is where you don't take prisoners, right? This is an attack where you imagine a complete destruction of your organization. And the attacker is unconstrained. The attacker is not constrained with technology, is not constrained with money, is not constrained with political regulation or any such issue. Imagine an unhinged attack. The second part of the battlefield is a defense, where if you've gone through an unhinged attack, and if that's the attack that is forthcoming, then what can you do to defend against it, and perhaps even better, counterattack? But when you do the defense, Kevin, it is very important to get down to ground reality. You are no longer unconstrained with resources, and neither are you unconstrained with technology. And neither are you unconstrained with regulatory frameworks around you.
So neither were your enemies or the attack constrained, neither are you. So I want to stop you for a sec.
Sorry, Kevin. Please. I'm sorry, I misspoke. What I meant to say is that you are constrained. So you in defense, there you go. Sorry, thanks for correcting me. You in the defense are constrained. The enemy is not, but you are, because that's your reality. yet you need to construct a defense, at least in the short, medium to long run horizon, which will slow down the enemy, perhaps even beat them, and like I said, even counterattack them, which is to preemptively prevent such an attack coming in.
So two questions for that. So I love, so what I love about, and I didn't say this earlier, but what I love about the process, the method, is that it is a process, and that it is, that it starts with mindset. I think that I'm glad that you mentioned that, because it's such an important part of what you're doing. And it leads me to a question. So you're leading a group through this process, mm-hmm. and you get to the battlefield, you know, piece. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing you've had leaders or executives say, well, wait a minute, there's nobody that's completely unhinged. There's no one that doesn't have any constraints, and they want to push back on that. Why is that so important? I think I know the answer, but why is that so important? And do you get resistance there when you're trying to get people to play along with the mental exercise?
We don't get the resistance on the unhinged and unconstrained part. That part they're able to see the value of, because they know the ultimate value to them is what will come out from the defense. And if they can defend themselves against an unhinged attacker, that really gives them a lot of confidence, right? That gives them a lot of, you know, the beauty of the defense is that it makes them feel empowered, which then makes them kind of, it's like a call to action, right? So they love that part. What they do push back against is when the discussion starts happening in the detail of, will this attack actually destroy you? And the pushback sometimes it comes as, yeah, but I find it very difficult for me to imagine that my customers will get attracted towards something like this. Or people end up saying, you know, I had an auto executive, without naming any names, who says, well, you know, I still like to hold the steering of my car and drive it, when we were talking about autonomous vehicles and what they can do to the auto industry. Or when we were talking about, you know, the sharing economy and what it can do to the auto industry. And this is back in the day, because we've been doing this for quite some time. And, you know, when the idea of sharing was picking up, even when we knew the writing on the wall, the auto industry was still pushing back and saying, no, it's just a taxi disruptor. This is not coming for us. You know, up until 2015, they did not recognize any of these Uber or Uber likes as a potential threat to them. And so they were pushing back against it. So we find a lot of pushback or statements like, oh, this has happened, something similar happened in the past, but they really didn't survive. And then I have to remind them, I'm like, it happened in the past, but did it happen in a way that you are, or perhaps there's something to learn, that how can it happen again so that they survive and destroy you? So right. Rather than focusing on the ones that didn't survive, can we reframe the question in a way that you figure out what would it take for an attacker like that to not only survive, but take you out? And, you know, a little bit of nudge here and there helps people to overcome that barrier and start thinking in terms of, you know, we could really go down and go down quickly. Now, that said, I must point out this resistance is seen little, Kevin, it's not too much. I actually find that the senior executives, when left to unconstrained environments, they go absolutely crazy, and they design attacks which are formidable, which are quite intense. And of course, because they have inside information, they actually know their weaknesses, they know where they're vulnerable. And so the attacker exploits, the virtual attacker exploits that insider information and is able to really create a formidable attack. Now, when it comes to defense, they have to rethink everything all over again. That's fine. But I feel the resistance is not as high as one may imagine would have been.
Excellent. So we've imagined a coordinated and unhinged attack, and we've imagined how we would respond and defend ourselves against that attack. What comes next after the battlefield?
Next is what we call the breakthrough. And the breakthrough is to now, and what the battlefield has given the options that perhaps we were previously never going to think about. And the breakthrough now is to take these options. and start thinking about how to embed them in the organization, which means you're going to have to start analyzing these options. Right now, you've just done a thought simulation. This is not good enough to change your strategy going forward. You have to now put data behind these things. You have to do a proper analysis. You need to dive a little bit deeper to get more information, perhaps run pilots, get the entire organization to rally behind some of these issues. And so that's the part that we call as the breakthrough, which is, you know, putting the show on the road kind of deal. And there, of course, you know, and by the way, this is the part firms are very good at. When given a strategy playbook, organizations know how to get that off the ground and start working behind it. It is getting the playbook ready, which has always been the problem. And so the breakthrough part is us really talking about, you know, getting this inside the firm's DNA and putting analysis behind it and then following through with action. One thing we do remind people constantly is that this is not a one-off exercise. Just because you were able to do an encounter and preempt an incoming disruption and future-proof your organization for the next few years doesn't mean that you're future-proof for eternity. This is, you know, this is one of those things where you have to do it all over again, almost literally, you know, from the very next day. And the pace at which you do this depends on the industry and the geography you operate in. But our observation is that the pace of disruption is only going to increase and not go down, which means we have to sort of do this repeatedly. And that part is also a part of getting this phoenix-like thinking into the DNA of an organization. So that's the last part. And in some sense, these are the three stages, the broad stages of the Phoenix Encounter method.
So many people who are listening or watching us right now are not CEOs. They're not sitting, they might not be in a room with you facilitating this process. So if I'm a leader somewhere in the middle of the organization, what's your message or what's your advice to me as we think about disruption, innovation, and everything that we've been talking about?
My message is that, you know, don't wait to be the CEO to start being a leader. You are responsible for your business, and your business may not be the firm's overall business. You may be a part of a smaller unit. You may be a part of a small department. You may have only three people working in your team with you. Well, you start there and you start thinking about how can you do what you do better? You know, what would be an encounter on you, which means your entire team becoming completely redundant? And how would you preempt it? So you can start at that micro level. Second thing that I would say is that if you have a brilliant idea and you think this is something that your organization should do, but you find it very difficult to convince people who you report to, don't convince them for your idea. Let them see your idea in person. So convince them for the encounter. Tell them, let's not, you know, don't preach your idea. Go in and say, hey, I read this book or I heard about this idea, and I would really like this to be something that we try. And if you can convince folks that are somewhat senior to you in the organization that let's run an encounter on the first Friday of January, or no, the first Friday is literally the first day. So the second, the second Friday of January, let's do this encounter. And you'd be surprised to see how people would actually see the burning platform that you were perhaps able to see even without the encounter. So it's a good tool to figure out how to protect your micro organization within the firm. It's also a great tool to convince people to do something which otherwise you may be struggling to do. So either way, this can be quite powerful. And I always say that, you know, in the organization, you should always act and behave towards your aspiration as opposed to your current job. So, you know, you may not be CEO, but it's a good idea to aspire to be it.
I think that's really, really great advice. We're talking with Samir Hazija, one of the co-authors of the Phoenix Encounter Method. And we're talking about this process all the way through. And I love, there's so many pieces that I know that as the author that you're saying, hey, here's the overall process. But there are some pieces inside of there that are really great that I believe in some ways could probably stand on their own. as mental exercises and group exercises. Having said that, if we go back to what you just suggested of having, you know, encouraging a group to try this, the encounter, and you say, we're going to do it on this particular Friday or whatever, how long, you know, if someone's got the book and they're excited by this conversation, they go get a copy of the book, they want to try it, like, how long is it going to take them to do it?
Kevin, this can be done anything between, you know, 3/4 of a day, a day, to sometimes even, you know, 4 to 5 days, depending on what is the depth at which we want to go. When we have done this with organizations, I have usually done it in a day or at most two. And I find that to be quite sufficient to get the conversation going. Now, remember, I go in there as an external facilitator. I have these conversations and we do it in a workshop format. And then the leadership of the organization that I work with, they take it to the next level amongst each other, where I am no longer a part of that. So the overall process can be much larger, but in terms of running the encounter to get you started, well, that can be done in a day or two. And to be honest with you, it is a great experience for executives to run it in terms of thinking about the strategy, breaking the blinkers. It's also a great bonding experience because, like I said, you end up creating the burning platform. And you know, one thing I've seen in organizations is when you see that there is a fight ahead of you, people come together. People let go of petty politics. They come together, they rally behind the organization, and they know that they now need to get stuff done because this is it. It is this moment where you're either going to make it or it's lights out.
It's interesting that you say that because I just wrote something this morning in terms of my lessons from the pandemic. And I was talking about it. I was thinking about it and writing about it on a slightly lower level, but it's the same idea. When we sent everybody home to work at home, you know, it was hard. People didn't know. A lot of people were questioning whether it would work at all. And yet, with sort of this common need to make it happen, we all figured out how to get it done, be the technology or just the work. Now, the longer we're at it, the more challenges we face. But in terms of getting off and getting it started, it's exactly an example of what you just said. Once people know what we got to do and that we got to do it, people will roll up their sleeves and get together, and they won't be focused on their fiefdoms and their departments and their business units. I think that's
absolutely, absolutely.
So since I mentioned that, the pandemic, what, you know, we're, as you and I are having this conversation, we're say 9 months into that. By the time people are watching or listening to this, it's still going to be here. But even if it were over by the time people hear it, sometime in the future, how has the pandemic impacted, or what have you learned from the doing the encounter or the need for the encounter even, related to the pandemic? How has the pandemic changed your thinking, I guess, is my question.
I think the pandemic has done two things which are, to me, very noticeable. The first thing is, I wouldn't call it a radical change, but it has really accelerated the adoption of emerging technologies. And in this book, we make a big deal about how technologies in today's day and age becoming one of the big disruptors, bigger than anything we've ever seen. Not because the idea of technology is new. I mean, we've seen technology since the steam engine getting developed and even before that, right? So the idea of technology is nothing new. But the rate of change, the pace of change, and moreover, how different technologies kind of interact with each other, that is very new and rapidly evolving. And the pandemic has accelerated that further. I mean, to give you an idea, you know, I live here in Singapore. It's a developed country. It's a great country, very forward-looking country. But it had one thing which even used to be a pet peeve of the government, which is a very forward-looking government, is that their payment systems are very archaic. The almost the entire economy used to run, at least the mom and pop stores and the, you know, they have these little hawker centers for food. It was all a cash economy, which is quite behind on the systems. I mean, at best a credit card, but really nothing forward-looking, right? Come pandemic, and you know, one of these days you go down to my neighborhood and there's a very nice hawker center with lots of kind of a street food fair kind of thing. And every shop there now has their own QR code. You go in, I take my phone, I don't carry any card, I don't carry any cash. It's completely contactless. I go, I pay, I just scan the QR code and the payment is done. And you know, this is not massively breakthrough technology, but this is an adoption that despite Singapore's development was simply not taking place because people just didn't get into it. And the pandemic just forced everybody to go contactless because nobody wanted to touch money that other people had touched, you know, for good or bad reasons, right? And next thing you know, it's completely cashless. So the adoption of robotics, the adoption of autonomous technology, the adoption of platforms, all of this has been accelerated. So that's one thing. The other thing, which I think is more transformational and, you know, beyond just accelerating the adoption of technology, is the realization that this world is going to be highly unpredictable. It has always been, but we were just not ready to accept it. You know, we've seen the unpredictability of the world, but perhaps businesses saw it and then they went down, and you know, maybe we didn't see it at very close quarters, but there isn't an individual in this world today, a single human being in this world, who has not felt and seen the uncertainty at close quarters now, right? I mean, and so the realization that this world is going to be highly uncertain, and that these black swans are going to be very, very difficult to predict, but they're definitely not going to be as rare as they are thought to be. I think that has set in. And it could also be paranoia. And maybe, you know, we go back to a world where things like this doesn't happen. And, you know, it takes another 100 years for something like this to happen. And I hope that's true. But I think the paranoia has set in. And it is not such a bad thing for leaders to start thinking about this world as a very uncertain place. Which means, and I believe that this Phoenix mindset that we've been promoting, this Phoenix attitude that we've been promoting, this to me, Kevin, to be very honest with you, becomes even more important. Now, I feel a little bit, there's a hint of arrogance for an author to say that their book is now becoming the most relevant piece of literature going forward. And I hope—
Yes, but honestly, the listeners, every author feels that way. I'm just saying.
No, but I hope the listeners don't take it that way because, you know, we have to be honest. We did not write this book after the pandemic. We wrote it much before the pandemic. We released it during the pandemic because we just knew that this is the right time to get this book out there. But we sincerely believe that this mindset of this Phoenix attitude, this whole concept of trying to reimagine yourself in the future because you can get destroyed has become much more important and relevant today than it was yesterday. And I think that's the big shift that we see.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things you just said that I want to highlight before we start to shift and move on. Before we do that, we should probably say, here's the other book that's going to change the world. It's my new book, The Long Distance Teammate. So this episode is brought to you by The Long Distance Teammate. You can learn more by going to longdistanceteammate.com. But I want to make two comments about what you said. One is, I think it's really relevant, your point about everyone wants to talk about this, the increasing rate of change. And I've actually read some stuff that says maybe it's not changing any faster than it has for a long time. I don't want to argue that one way or the other. But the other part of what you said, I think, is unassailable. And that is that the new technologies that are coming can be combined and integrated in ways that none of the ways that ever happened before. And that's a huge piece, because what I found is sometimes people, you start talking about the rapid speed of change and people nod their heads, but they're not really, yeah. It's kind of like whatever, right? But that second piece that you said, I think, is critically important and profoundly true. And the second thing that I wanted to loop back to briefly was your point that having all of us now having lived through or during or whatever words you want to use this pandemic, maybe it's a healthy level of paranoia to say, hey, at any given time, the disruptions could come. And so I think it does set the table, as you said, for us to be more aware and perhaps more ready to look at what the future might be, uncertain as it might be. I think it's a really super important point.
That's right. And I think it was Andy Grove who wrote this book, right? Only the Paranoid Survive. And, you know, I mean, we've talked about these things before, but I just think that sometimes when there is a surge of growth, we tend to forget these things and we enjoy the waves that are coming in our way, which are favorable. And then a rogue wave comes and then makes us realize that, hey, we need to remember that the world is much more uncertain than we think it is.
Exactly. So when you're not helping organizations, teaching students, doing podcasts, what do you do for fun, Shamir?
Oh, fun. Well, you know, sports, reading is a lot of fun for an academic. You know, it's a pleasure to be an academic because I get paid to read. So it's fun that way. But yeah, I indulge in sports a lot because I also think it's one of those things which allows me or gives me time to think about things, right? So in the middle of a swim, it's one of those me times when I can start thinking about, you know, what next and what's important and what is it that I should be studying or researching. And that's, you know, and family, of course, takes a lot of time. I have a young family. So spending time with them is fantastic.
Perfect. So you mentioned reading. So what's something that you're reading now or have read recently that people might find interesting?
Oh, I'm actually reading a fascinating book, I must say. It's called The Dragons and the Snakes, How the Rest Learned to Fight the West. This is by this guy called David Kilcullen. I think he's an Australian guy. It's funny because I'm going to get stereotyped by your listeners as a guy who writes about Phoenix encounters and reads books about wars and stuff like that. But it's a fascinating book, and I think it's pretty deep and compelling analysis that the author has done. And I had just finished another one called Superintelligence, which I quite enjoyed as well, written by a philosopher talking about, you know, how artificial intelligence in its ultimate form can be extremely dangerous for us unless we get our frameworks right. So just fantastic books, and it's been fascinating to be able to read all these authors and their point of view. And again, Kevin, to be honest with you, it keeps coming back to the Phoenix encounter in my mind. Like every time I read a book, I'm like, oh, I can connect this to our method and our process. But that's, I guess, a bias in me.
Well, that's the bias we all have, right? Is to connecting it back to the things that we hold dear and that we find valuable. I will just say this, that for everybody, we'll make sure that the links to those books are all in the show notes. You can go find all those. And while you've mentioned wars and battlefields, it's pretty clear to me in our short conversation that your countenance says that you're not necessarily a battler or you're not necessarily a warmonger. It's certainly been a pleasure to visit with you, Shamir. So where can we learn more about you and your work? Where do you want to point people in relationship to your work in the book?
Kevin, the best place to learn about me would be my website, because I constantly update it. I write articles and I put it up on the website, give links to everything else that I find interesting and relevant, which is at samirhasija.com. So it's just my full name.com, Shamir Hasija. And you know, I keep it updated. And of course, anybody wants to get in touch, I have my contact details up there so they can get in touch, and I'm happy to get back to them.
Perfect. Thank you so much. So Shamir, thank you for being here. I've got a question for everybody else before we go. The question I ask you every week, and that is, now what? What action are you going to take as a result? Maybe you're now more aware and thinking about the possible disruptions that are around you, and you're already doing that opening piece of the encounter of seeking. Maybe you're really intrigued by the mindset of the Phoenix idea, and maybe that's what's got you thinking. Whatever it is, the challenge for you is not to just find this interesting or to find it edifying, but to take action on it. And I think both Shamir and I would hope that whatever it is that you took from this, that you would take action on it and not just say, that was interesting. So I hope that you will do that. And Shamir, thanks again so much for being here and for staying up late for you and I to have this conversation. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Kevin. It was my pleasure. Thanks a lot. And this is very interesting. Thank you.
You're welcome. So everybody, we're here every week, and you can be back next week to join us. I hope you'll do that. You can make sure that you connect with us on either our Facebook or LinkedIn groups, where you can get additional information. You can even give us feedback on what you think we should be doing in the future. We hope you'll do that. And we hope you'll be back here next week for another episode of the Remarkable Leadership Podcast. Thanks, everybody.